Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's said that those who ignore history are condemned to repeat it. As the United States attempts to pacify Iraq, its soldiers may be fighting more than Ba'athists and the Mahdi army. The bitter memory of colonial rule is fresh in the Middle Eastern mind, says our guest tonight, and the cost of ignoring it may be high. Tonight on Point, the ghosts of empire in the Middle East, in Iraq. But first, a check-in on the standoff in Fallujah, where Iraqi insurgents and U.S. Marines today fought a pitched battle in spite of a so-called ceasefire. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. I asked him what the Pentagon is learning from the situation in Fallujah.
There are a few things the Pentagon's learning, but I'm not sure the military lessons are the most important. I think the broader issue is what's happening to the Iraqi population when they watch, and are they becoming more intimidated by American power and respectful of it, or are they becoming more angry at the United States for its actions and what they sometimes see as our callous disregard for Muslim life? I think the military already had a pretty good handle on the nature of urban warfare, and they're pretty good at it, but our high-tech advantages don't play nearly as well or as overwhelmingly to our advantage in this environment. Even if we manage to arrest or kill 5 or 10 Iraqi insurgents for every 1 American we lose, it's still not nearly the kind of overall advantage we'd like to have. So we're good at it, but we're not great at it, and technology is not a panacea, and those are the main lessons, but the Pentagon already knew those. Now, if you wanted to get more detailed, you could say, are there specific tactical things they're learning about Fallujah, where insurgents may be located, where their weapons are stored, how they communicate internally? Yes, I'm sure all those sorts of things are being studied and better understood. But the basic issue here has less to do with military matters than the broader politics of Iraq and how the efforts in Fallujah may be affecting them, unfortunately and negatively, for the United States.
In that sense, a lesson perhaps in the limits of military power. You seem to be, to some extent, answering your own question there and suggesting that, in fact, Iraqis may be also learning the limits of U.S. military power when it's put up against political realities like those of civilians in Fallujah.
That's right, although much of the Muslim world has learned these lessons in the past, because this is far from the first case. We all tend to think Vietnam when we think insurgency and counterinsurgency in the United States, but in the Arab world, they think of Algeria. That's certainly one of the most important modern cases, where the Algerian insurgency defeated the French colonial power 40 years ago. And they think of Somalia, where the United States was essentially pushed out in 1993, and they think of Lebanon, where Israel could not maintain an occupation, and then going to the north and east, beyond the Arab world, but still in the broader Islamic world, they think of Afghanistan, where the Soviets were driven out, and they tend to think there's a very good chance they could do the same thing to us here, and that is frankly not a crazy theory, and unfortunately, even if it's wrong, we're going to have to prove them wrong by a lot of hard fighting.
How can that be proven? As you've watched the so-called ceasefire of recent days, has it looked to you as though there's a real legitimate ceasefire conversation going on, or is the U.S. military simply trying to buy time to figure out what to do? Do they have an option other than walking away or flattening Fallujah, which neither of which look attractive?
Yes, I think we have a middle option, because frankly, I don't think that the military benefits of flattening the resistance in Fallujah are worth taking down much of the city or being seen as taking down much of the city. And therefore, even if we cannot achieve a negotiated settlement that fully eliminates the heavy weaponry in the hands of the insurgents, we should settle for a glass half full, because that's all we're going to get anyway, even if we apply the military sledgehammer with the utmost severity. So I think the negotiations should be serious, because we should not want to go back into Fallujah the way we went in a couple weeks ago.
Michael O'Hanlon, what was it that the U.S. military really wanted when they first pulled up to Fallujah and announced that they were going to have satisfaction for those Americans who were killed and their bodies mutilated? They've said that they wanted the city to give up the people who did it, but it was a mob that appeared to do it. So what did they really want, some kind of sacrificial offering of individuals who would be accused with those murders?
I have to admit I'm not sure, and I'm as quick as the next guy to praise the U.S. military 99 times out of 100, but in their handling of Fallujah in the last year, I'm not quite as impressed. We went from the general Rumsfeld concept for post-Saddam Iraq, which was hands-off, let them enjoy themselves a little, let the chaos reign, which was a terrible strategy, mostly Mr. Rumsfeld's fault, I believe, but still the uniform military was somewhat complicit. We went from that to a lot of raids last summer to sort of a standoff strategy late fall and winter as the 82nd Airborne largely left Fallujah. And then the Marines arrived in the winter and decided it was time to go in and reassert a sense of law and order and try to be actually in some ways kinder to the Iraqi population by trying to restore a basic decent level of security to them so they could go about their lives. But alas, that led to the terrible events of the last month. In other words, there's been a lot of waffling around about tactics, a lot of reasonable disagreement. The problem is that you cannot change your mind four different times in the space of 12 months and expect to have any clear interpretation of your actions on the part of the population you're trying to influence.
Is the United States military at risk tonight of losing the respect and even fear, if we must look at it that way, of a broader Iraqi populace? Is there a way to win, even by a glass half-full measure, in Fallujah?
Well, there's a way to limit our damages. Speaking of winning in Fallujah these days is not something that it's not the kind of language I would use because I'm pretty pessimistic and pretty frustrated. I know all Americans are deeply troubled, and my concerns are first and foremost with the military, even though I also have some doubts about the tactics the commanders are electing to use at this moment. But frankly, I don't think we have a great outcome that we can achieve here, regardless of which way we go. The best hope is to essentially contain the problem and get on with life in the rest of Iraq, where people are not as opposed to the United States, not as cynical about our actions. Actually, in some cases, they're worried about the very Ba'athists that we're fighting in Fallujah and are not going to hold it against us that we went in there once heavy, as long as we don't keep escalating the kinds of urban fighting that we've seen the last month and which wind up killing so many innocent Iraqis as well as the Iraqi insurgents. So I think here we should just try to limit our damages and not try to turn this into some big success. We're going to achieve success in Iraq by creating stability and law and order and economic recovery and a smooth political transition, not by winning some massive firefight in the heart of the Sunni Triangle.
Sounds like a tough needle to thread, but there's the challenge. Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Michael O'Hanlon is Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with us from Washington. In his State of the Union address in January, President Bush vowed to, quote, finish the historic work of democracy in Afghanistan and Iraq so those nations can light the way for others and help transform a troubled part of the world. Our guest tonight warns the Middle East has heard that kind of high-blown talk before and that a history of Western imperialism has associated it with lies and subjugation. This hour on Point, the imperial legacy that surrounds and colors the American occupation of Iraq. How much colonial history did you know when the U.S. crossed the border into Iraq? Are the Marines in Fallujah fighting invisible centuries of resistance to imperial intervention? Is there room to escape history in the Middle East, room to build democracy Bush-style? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies and Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. His new book is Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. Good evening and welcome, Rashid Khalidi.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Rashid Khalidi, you describe a kind of picture in the Middle East, in Iraq right now, where American troops and their efforts are surrounded by the ghosts of the past that have gone unacknowledged. What is it that has not been part of the conversation that you think needs to be heard?
Well, I think that the people who made the decisions to go into Iraq consciously ignored history. They didn't want to know. They rigorously excluded anyone who could tell them, within the government or without, that what we did in Iraq was going to be seen in terms of Iraqis' perceptions and history, not in terms of what we said we were going to do. And they ignored, perhaps purposely, the fact that every invader in the past 200 years has used almost identical rhetoric to that which the Bush administration was using. And so the Iraqis feel that they've seen it before.
So when you look out tonight at the standoff in Fallujah, at a standoff apparently as well in Najaf, and try and project into the Iraqi mindset there. Are you saying that they all see the Americans as just coming in train of earlier colonial powers, Great Britain in Iraq's case? We've heard a lot from Iraqis over months before now about their hopes for a new Iraq.
Well, I think Iraqis obviously saw it, and I think that at the very outset, many were exceedingly relieved to have the previous regime, the Saddam Hussein Ba'athist regime, removed. But different Iraqis, I have to repeat, see it differently. Fallujah happens to be the place where the 1920 revolt against the British erupted, with the killing of a British officer, Colonel Leachman, by the grandfather of the man who's the spokesman of the rebels there today. I doubt that anybody among the neocons who decided on this war in Washington had any idea where Fallujah was or that it was extremely important to Iraqis. Karbala is a place that resonates for all Shia. So, I mean, each Iraqi sees these things somewhat differently, but a lot of them have common memories of a variety of things. And I don't think that the people who made these decisions, and by this I'm not actually talking about the military, the soldiers, and I'm not talking about the people in the intelligence community or the State Department. I'm talking about the civilian echelon of the Pentagon, the people in the National Security Council, the people around Vice President Cheney, who made all the decisions, rigorously excluding anybody who had any knowledge of anything about the Middle East. These people didn't know, didn't care about these things.
Rashid Khalidi, give us the thumbnail tour, if you would, of the colonial history of this region. You describe it as being roughly two centuries now. But take us back so that we've got the basics of this schema that you say many Arabs still have freshly in mind.
Well, this is a region that, you know, dominated its part of the world for close to a millennium. And before that was the scene of great world empires for many millennia. And it's a region where people have a lot of pride, and they think of their past. And they also felt humiliated when Western powers, starting with Napoleon in Egypt in 1798, and then later on the British and the French, came in and were able to push them around with a great deal of ease, or relative ease, it appeared. And there has been a process of resistance to that from the moment that Napoleon arrived. He landed. He issued a proclamation, which he told them, and within a few months, the Egyptians had killed the commander of his army in Cairo, and he had to bombard the city from the citadel with his heavy artillery. And that's pretty much the way it's gone. The French had the same warm reception in Algeria in 1830. The British had the same kind of reception in Egypt in 1882, and so on and so forth. So, without going into detail, one of the major, themes of modern Middle East history, only one, is this external intervention, internal resistance. Another has been the desire of people in that part of the world to limit authoritarian governments, to move towards constitutional forms, and to establish some kind of democracy. And this is something that goes back to the 1870s in the case of much of the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire had a constitution and elections in 1876-77. Iran had a constitution and elections in 1905. Most of these countries had really serious attempts, Tunisia, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and so on, to establish some form of constitutional government. So the idea that they don't have any idea what democracy is, there's no liberal strand or trend in this part of the world, is just based on ignorance and I think also contempt, frankly.
So you're saying that this notion that democracy has to be brought in from outside is wrong?
Well, I would argue that's true in all places and all times. The ideas, if they have any value, are, of course, universal. And the United States has the oldest functioning constitution of any place. So we do have things we can tell people. But I don't think we can go in there and act like a bunch of tutors to a bunch of ignorant, benighted people with rags on their heads, which is, it seems to me, the way a lot of what the coalition provisional authority has been doing, telling the Iraqis what their flag should be, which we have just done as of today, telling them what their constitution should be, does not seem to me to be the way to go about this.
Wow. Rashid Khalidi, there's a lot more we want to hear. I want to invite our callers to join the conversation as well. We're talking tonight with Rashid Khalidi about the ghosts of empire in the Middle East, in Iraq. His new book is Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. You can join the conversation. How much colonial history of the Mideast did you know when U.S. troops crossed the border into Iraq? Are U.S. Marines in Fallujah tonight fighting two centuries of resistance to Western intervention is the room for something new in the Middle East, room to escape history and build democracy Bush-style. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the legacy of Western imperialism that surrounds and colors America's occupation of Iraq. My guest is Rashid Khalidi, professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and author of the new book, Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints in America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. You can join our conversation when Iraqi civilians loot American Humvees, as they did today in Baghdad. Are they acting out old anti-imperialist impulses? Is the Bush effort in Iraq fundamentally different from two centuries of European intervention in the Middle East? Do you buy Rashid Khalidi's view that the American effort in Iraq is a prisoner at some level of imperial history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rashid Khalidi, we are in every instance encouraged to see the American intervention in very different terms from the historical colonial imperialist interventions that you describe in your book. We're encouraged to see this as the toppling of a terrible tyrant and killer, and a good-hearted effort to bring democracy to a country that was under the boot.
Well, I'm saying two things. The first thing I'm saying is, whatever we think we're doing, let's put that aside for the moment. Or whatever we actually are doing, let's put that aside for a moment. There is an important thing to keep in mind. These are people with, A, a long history, much longer than ours, thousands and thousands of years longer than ours, and, B, a great attention to history, which unfortunately Americans don't have. So just because we're amnesiac as a people, there are reasons for that. They're not, and there are reasons for that. So that's the first point. They have a set of perceptions, and they're going to see what we do in terms of their experience. And their recent experience has been that many foreign powers have marched in there over the last couple of hundred years proclaiming a desire to liberate them, only to put them under their rule. Then there's the question of what are our proclaimed intentions. Well, Americans never go abroad. I argue this in the book. Americans never go abroad. Or can never be persuaded to go abroad, but for a grand purpose. So whether it's President Wilson and his 14 points, whether it's President Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms, American presidents have to sell, as it were, any project abroad to people who have a suspicion of the outside and of foreigners. We're a continent which is also an island. And our founders, rightly, I think, said, you know, don't go abroad in search of monsters to slay. Stay away from European entanglements. And so when we do go abroad, there has to be a grand purpose. So that American presidents are proclaiming a grand purpose, whatever they do, is standard operating practice. Then there's finally the question of what are we up to? And here I would say we should look very carefully at what has happened in the last year. For the last year, Americans have made every single decision in Iraq, every single decision. The members of the Iraqi Governing Council can't meet with anybody without two American minders. Iraqis know these things. So they're contrasting the promises that they heard when the hated regime of Saddam was overthrown a year ago and what has happened in a year. And they're saying, well, these guys are beginning to look like General Maud in 1917 or Napoleon in 1798.
What are the examples from history, Rashid Khalidi, of imperial powers who came promising liberation or even democracy?
Well, very few came promising anything else. In the book, I begin a chapter by quoting Napoleon in 1798, General Maud as he entered Baghdad in 1917, and Donald Rumsfeld last April as saying almost exactly the same thing. I could have added several other quotes, actually. There was a quote from a British general in 1882 and so on. Invariably, European imperial powers have said that they were there to better the lot of the people. And in some ways they did, but almost invariably they came to stay for bases, for strategic advantage, for oil, for other things, and they didn't leave, and they didn't allow the people to rule themselves. In fact, one of the other arguments of the book has been that the main obstacle to democracy, or one of the main obstacles to democracy, has been, in this part of the world, has been that it has been systematically sabotaged by the intervention of foreign powers. The British and the French did this for decades and decades and decades. The United States, unfortunately, has started doing it since the Cold War. Some of your listeners may remember American and British involvement in the overthrow of a constitutional elected government in Iran in 1953. It's not the only time we've been engaged in that kind of thing.
You quote General Maud, as you say, commander of British forces in Baghdad, March 19th, 1917. Here's what he says. Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators. It is the hope and desire of the British people and the nations in alliance with them that the Arab race may rise once more to greatness and renown among the peoples of the earth. And then, of course, Donald Rumsfeld, April of last year, unlike many armies in the world, you came not to conquer, not to occupy, but to liberate. And the Iraqi people know this, speaking to American troops. So
Napoleon, two centuries ago, says, I have not come to you except for the purpose of restoring your rights from the hands of the oppressors. So the same rhetoric has been echoing for more than two centuries.
But let me ask you this, Rashid Khalidi. While it's possible to be, in your word, amnesiac about the past, is it also possible to be blind to the potential of the future? Is it absolutely necessary to play out this same dynamic again and again? Are there not, have you seen no evidence of Iraqis in the last year open to the idea, the possibility of something new, of democracy here?
Well, I think that we should go back and look at what happened in the first 6 months after the Saddam regime was overthrown. There were very few American casualties for the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
There was no widespread resistance. There was barely any resistance at all. The only really bloody incident was, strange to say, in Fallujah a year ago. And this was when supposedly there was some sniping at American troops, or at least American troops felt that they had been fired at. And they fired on a crowd, killing 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the ensuing days, other demonstrators were killed. But that was almost the only major incident for a very long time after the occupation of Iraq. We basically botched up in that period. The United States botched up in that period. Now, I think there are reasons for that that have to do with what the objectives of this administration really were. But there was a time there, a window there, during which Iraqis were not active, or most, the overwhelming majority of Iraqis clearly, A, were not actively resisting the occupation, and B, I think were, as you suggest, open-minded about the possibility that something better might be coming. And I don't actually think that all of this was preordained. I think to some extent it was, because I think that there are things that the administration is not really talking about, like the fact we absolutely intend to keep bases in Iraq permanently, or at least as long as we can.
Mm-hmm.
We absolutely intend to have, if we can, a predominant place in the Iraqi oil business. And these are things that I don't think the Iraqis are going to take kindly to. And I think that's one of the very important reasons for some of the resistance that the United States is facing. But I still think the Iraqis were prepared to give the United States the benefit of the doubt in spite of their bitter experiences, partly because of how hated the previous regime was and how much of a sense of liberation most Iraqis felt simply from the removal of that regime. I do think, though, that the hideous looting and the total disorder and collapse of any kind of governance for months thereafter, months and months and months, almost made impossible the possibility of a really rapid move to a better situation.
But you're saying that in spite of that open mind, at least among a portion of the Iraqi population...
I would say a majority.
Even a majority. Are you saying that the United States acted so perversely or so inappropriately somehow that it lost that opportunity in that brief window of time? It so thoroughly proved that its motives were not noble, were not altruistic?
We now know how incredibly ineptly Iraq has been governed for this past
year. But ineptitude is different from...
No, I understand. But this is what the Iraqis are seeing. They see what looks to them like the inexplicable inability of a country that can put a man on the moon to give them better electricity than the Saddam Hussein regime did under sanctions.
And so all of a sudden George Bush is Napoleon Bonaparte because...
Well, there's that, and there's the fact that an occupying army is an occupying army. Our army is not a police force. The Marines, the paratroopers, the U.S. Army is organized to fight and kill. That's what armies do. You put an army into a city, you put a main battle tank onto a boulevard, you put an Apache helicopter, you put guys whose training is, as soon as a shot is fired, to do certain things. And I'm not blaming them. I'm with Michael Hanlon, who, your previous guest.
Mm.
You put them there, and they are going to do things that are going to, how shall I say, not win friends and influence people. There is nothing you can do with a sledgehammer except use it as a sledgehammer. And any occupation army, absent a really clear strategy on turning them into policemen, and that strategy didn't exist and still doesn't exist, is going to alienate people very, very quickly, and that's what's happened.
But what about the argument that we hear from Washington that, mm-hmm. as you say, a majority of Iraqis want democracy, want a transformation here, that those hopes are being thwarted or that attempt is underway by a minority of right-wing, or I should say fundamentalist religious terrorists or fanatics or Ba'athist leftovers. I mean, the idea that they need help to get rid of this group that would stand in the way of that democratic transformation.
Anybody who tells you today, in April of 2004, that the people fighting the United States are a tiny minority is not looking at Iraqi politics carefully. The Sunnis and the Shia of Iraq, according to the reporting I'm reading, which is in English language newspapers, not just Arabic mm-hmm. Satellite mm-hmm. channels, mm-hmm. indicates that overwhelming majorities of Iraqis, certainly among the Sunni and the Shia, probably not the Kurds, are now very, very, very opposed to the American occupation. Even the generals were saying that. American generals have been saying that increasingly recently. So what were tiny remnants of the regime? What were militant Islamists, what were Iraqi nationalists, very isolated at the outset, have now managed to win over a majority, what appears to be a majority of Iraqis. And I have to say, the policies implemented by the Pentagon, which ran Iraq, has been running Iraq, runs Iraq, are what encouraged most Iraqis to move over to the opposing side, putting in a bunch of carpetbaggers who came in on the back of American tanks, who were loathed, if anybody knows them at all in Iraq, was a strategy of contempt for the Iraqis.
You're talking about Ahmed Chalabi and
I'm talking about scores of people who came in with the U.S. military at the insistence of their personal friends and business partners in the Pentagon, and like Chalabi, exactly, and who, if they're known anywhere, are known as thieves or Tel Aviv is a convicted criminal. I mean, he actually was convicted of several hundred million dollars.
In Jordan, and of course he protests that, but nevertheless it's there.
Well, he's also under indictment in Switzerland, so it's not just the Jordanians.
Yeah. Rashid Khalidi, a lot of people want to join this conversation. I'd like to turn to them. We're talking tonight with Columbia University Professor of Arab Studies, Rashid Khalidi, author of the new book, Resurrecting Empire. Steve is calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have a very quick point, but I love this conversation so much. I was able to get on and talk to Bill Kristol, one of the neocons, just before the war started when they were banging the drums, and I asked him explicitly, where he's getting his information from. Had he ever lived in the Middle East? Does he speak Arabic? And, all these questions about the cultural issues at play. And he said, as a part of somebody's speechwriter, I might have traveled through one or two of these countries, but he had never really been in a country for very long to understand that the vast cultural differences of the Middle East. And then he finally told me that he got his information. All he needed to do was read Amnesty International to get his information to invade Iraq.
And Steve, are you suggesting by that Bill Kristol and the neocons, neoconservatives, were widely ignorant of Middle Eastern history, or knew it but didn't care, had a different vision, a new perspective?
Oh, I I hate to answer that question. I think they're. They could have some textbook knowledge, but I think they were relatively ignorant, or they were willfully ignorant. But beyond that, they really had little idea of what they were getting into as far as the culture, the man on the street kind of thing. And I had lived in Egypt for 4 years, and I knew immediately that this was going to be a firestorm of it was going to be an intense situation, and people in the Middle East, and I don't want to stereotype or generalize, but they're a little bit different than we are. They're not worse or better, but there's a cultural thing you need to understand. When you go rampaging through their country, they're going to respond in certain ways. One of them is just going to be the way they pass news along and how they see things. It's a bit different than here. And I got the feeling Bill Kristol had no clue what he was talking about personally, and that he just wanted to remove this guy for he had ulterior motives as far as I was concerned.
One of the things I suggest in the book is that what your caller said about Bill Kristol, who after all is not in government, is unfortunately true of, among others, the number three man in the Pentagon, who is in day-to-day charge of the occupation of Iraq.
Douglas Feith.
Mm-hmm. It's true of Richard Perle, who headed Rumsfeld's advisory board. It's true of Wormser, a man who is Vice President Cheney's NSC guy on Iraq. These are people who are profoundly ignorant of Iraq or the Middle East, really profoundly ignorant. And I show in the book how they really don't know a Sunni from a Shia, from a document that they proudly authored and is still up on the web.
So how do you then, Rashid Khalidi, read their motivation, which our caller from Duluth raises?
Well, I would suggest one motivation is this desire for bases to replace the bases that everybody in the Pentagon knew could not be kept in Saudi Arabia. One of the biggest mistakes the United States has ever made in its history was to put military bases in Saudi Arabia during and after the last Gulf War, the first Gulf War. All Saudis look with great suspicion on foreign bases in their country. And it was a ticking time bomb, and sadly it has gone off in the face of American servicemen and other foreigners and Saudis who've been killed by bin Laden and other terrorist groups as well. But one of the reasons for that was that American bases were widely unwelcome in Saudi Arabia, and so they wanted to move them. And bases in Iraq looked like a great idea. The Iraqis would love us. They didn't have any reason to say that except the pap that Ahmed Chalabi and other exiles were feeding them. But they gladly believed it. This is a faith-based administration, fact-free and faith-based foreign policy that they're running. What they believe, as far as they're concerned, is reality.
Let's try and get one more call before the break. Mudaffer is calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudaffer. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I salute the guests you have there. Thank you, Professor Khalidi. I am Iraqi myself, and I fought Saddam Hussein in 91, and I might give you a message from Iraq itself, which most of my friends who were in the resistance against Saddam is saying now, that the student is gone with Saddam Hussein, and the teacher is here.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, Iraqis know there is no difference between Saddam Hussein and George Bush. It's probably George Bush has more weapon and tactic, more of civilized killing than Saddam Hussein, who was brutal and kind of a jungle type of killer.
Mudaffer, you know, that's awfully hard for Americans to kill tonight. To hear tonight, we see the pictures of young American soldiers in harm's way, fighting, we want to believe, for the liberation, for a better society in Iraq. And those young men and women look like they're having not much fun out there.
No, I am telling you, sir, liberation doesn't come by supporting the dictator before and replacing, like Professor Khalili said, most of the puppets, which has no respect by all Iraqis. I mean, this government council, which has no power at all, and yet they are forced to represent Iraq, and when all Iraqis doesn't have any respect to them. This is like first denial of Iraqi future of democracy. So Iraqis are not stupid to differentiate between imposing people on them or letting them choose their representatives. I mean, this is from the beginning was a clear cut to Iraqis that they will never have the choice to choose their future, to choose their ruler.
Mudaffer, we've got to take a break here, but I thank you for your call. These are hard words to hear. We're going to come back with Rashid Khalidi and talk about what should happen here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Can the United States and Iraq step beyond history? Is there history here that we have to deal with? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Rashid Khalidi about the ghosts of empire in the Middle East in Iraq. His new book is Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. You can join our conversation tonight. Are U.S. Marines in Fallujah fighting two centuries of imperial resistance? Is there room for something new in the Middle East, room to escape history and build democracy Bush-style? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm actually a student at Harvard, and we were just having this conversation today about exactly what's going on, and there's a ton of anti-Bush sentiment out there right now at my university.
Mm-hmm.
And the one question that I guess I have is, and I can appreciate exactly what Rashid is saying, but what does Bush do now? I mean, if he were President Bush, where would he go with this whole situation?
That's the question. Mark, thanks for raising it. Rashid Khalidi.
Well, the president may not like to do this, but if he wants to end the shedding of Iraqi and American blood, he is going to have to say that he made a mistake. He is going to have to very quickly make it clear to the Iraqis something that they do not believe, which is, as the previous caller was suggesting, they are actually going to be allowed to choose their future rulers very quickly. He may intend to do that. I don't think he does myself. So far, he's given no evidence of that, or he and his advisors. But if this is going to be changed, the situation is going to be changed, the United States has to give up control very quickly. And up till this moment, the Pentagon has insisted on controlling every single decision in Iraq, every single decision that's made relating to Iraq, what kind of investment decisions, the flag they will have, the constitution they'll have, who will be in this ministry, who will be in that ministry. That kind of thing has made the Iraqis think, as the previous caller suggested, he's an Iraqi. He fought Saddam Hussein.
Mudafar, yes.
He said. And it's made most Iraqis think that this country really wants to control Iraq's future. The president's going to have to, if he's capable of doing it, admit some mistakes there. And
this sounds so thoroughly implausible.
Pardon me?
That sounds so thoroughly unlikely. I mean,
well,
at his recent press conference, he couldn't name one mistake, let alone to say that going into Iraq was a mistake. But let me ask you just on that.
Mm-hmm.
The picture that we're given is that if the U.S. should withdraw, and even John Kerry says the same thing, if the U.S. should withdraw, it will be chaos, a bloodbath, upheaval. This will be a sump of terrorist activity and a nightmare in the Middle East. Simply can't be ducked. The U.S. has to stay and see this through, we're told.
I think that Senator Kerry, if that is in fact his belief, is wrong. It is true, as Secretary Powell said to the president, according to the Woodward book, that when you go in there, it belongs to you, in the sense that the occupying power is responsible for everything. If there's a mess in Iraq today that's worse than it otherwise would have been, the United States, as the occupying power, is responsible.
Well, fine, but does walking away solve that?
So withdrawing, I was about to say, withdrawing immediately and in an irresponsible fashion, in my view, would be to compound the many mistakes, the innumerable mistakes that have already been made. But it has to be clear that the United States will leave quickly. It has to be clear that the United States is going to get some external power in there to broker as quickly as possible a handover of power to representative Iraqis. And at that point, it's the Iraqis' problem, even though I would argue we are still responsible. But I think this idea that the Iraqis can't handle it themselves, well, it's for the Iraqis to decide. It is their country in the last analysis.
Yes, it is. When you wrote the book, Rashid Khalidi, your prescription was that Iraq be put under some kind of UN mandate,
right,
at least for a time. Is that still the way you feel?
I would still say, though, I think the chances for that are much less great than they were when I finished writing the book, which was back in the fall. I didn't think things would go as bad as quickly as they have, though I was afraid they were going to go in this direction. There may not be any more time for that to work, but I think that the only slim chance of this not turning into a long-term disaster for the United States, not to speak of the Iraqis in the Middle East, is as rapidly as possible for a UN broker transition to a representative Iraqi government.
And if the United States should move out on a fast timetable, what's your level of confidence that the Iraq that emerges on the other side of that will be stable, will be, won't be a mess itself?
I can tell you that if the United States keeps troops there, it will not be stable. If the United States keeps troops there, it will be impossible to have elections. If the United States keeps troops there, you will have continued resistance. That I can tell you. So to say the alternative is between killing the only few terrorists between the United States and stability and between total chaos, that's a false dichotomy. The alternative is between endless bloodshed, a situation where the United States can neither win or fish or cut bait, and between the possibility, which I personally now think is small, but I think it is a possibility for the Iraqis pulling it out. I mean, there is such a thing as Iraqi nationalism. There is an Iraqi desire to have democracy. But you're going to have you have a country where a democratic tradition is weak. You have a country that suffered under one of the most filthy dictatorships in modern history. You have a country where the United States has reduced the country to a state of a very poor third world country where it was a second world country. I mean, our 12 years of sanctions have basically decreased Iraqi GDP per capita by about 75%. They're three-quarters poorer than they were in 1991. That's partly the fault of their own government, but it's also partly the fault of sanctions.
Let me get another call or two. Amita's calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Hi, Amita. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just had a question about, we're talking about why or how the president won't seem to apologize or say he was sorry for any of the actions in Iraq. But it surprises me because when a lot of people I speak to, Americans, I mean, every day, seem to have the same kind of delusion. They still believe that we went into Iraq to liberate the Iraqis. I mean, despite 1 year having passed and so many facts having emerged, I find it hard to believe that so many of us still believe that we went in there to liberate the Iraqis.
So what do you think the motive was, Amita? I mean, what then?
Well, it's clear that, you know, we needed some action to have taken place after September 11th. We felt that there was a, you know, this kind of could have sort of taken care of some of those feelings that emerged after September 11th in order to seek redressal for the wrongs that were done on us. Besides, I think the press has revealed that the Bush regime had an agenda in any case on the Middle East, which also included, as per Bob Woodard's book, an attack on Iraq, Afghanistan and Iraq.
Amita, our time is short, but we've got it, and I thank you for your call. Rashid Khalidi, what about, there are, of course, very opposing views to your own here. Neil Ferguson, the British writer, saying the U.S. has to pick up the imperial mantle, the mantle of empire. It's its responsibility now to stick with it.
I think anybody who believes that is attracted by that thesis should read very carefully a history of the various empires that have marched through the Middle East in the last couple of centuries. They have left a trail of bloodshed. They have made themselves loathed. If Neil Ferguson wants the United States to leave a trail of bloodshed in the Middle East and wants the United States to be loathed, well, that's what we'll get from picking up what he calls the imperial burden. I think that is a very, very foolish and misguided advice. The United States is a greater power than the world has ever known. And no matter what it does, that power is going to be used one way or another for good or for ill. But picking up the imperial burden is probably the worst way to use that power.
We've just got a minute left. You were saying that at this point you think there's a small chance that the Iraqis could pull this out, could fall back on their own sense of nationalism, mm-hmm. and be successful after U.S. withdrawal. But a small chance means there's a large chance that it would go in another way. What's your fear? Civil war? Something else?
I actually think a struggle for power more than a civil war. In other words, I don't think it'll be the Sunnis versus the Shia, which is the favorite scenario of some people who don't know that much about Iraq. I think actually there will be a struggle among Sunnis, among Shia, and it might come out right. You might end up with a democratic regime. It might not even be a terribly bloody struggle, but I'm not terribly sanguine. I think things were bad in Iraq before the United States invaded, but we've actually made them a lot worse.
Rashid Khalidi, we're out of time, but we're grateful to you for joining us tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rashid Khalidi, professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and author of Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints, and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, reflections from a mother whose son's deployment in Iraq has just been extended. This is On Point. Three more U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq today, two when a Baghdad building exploded and one in a firefight in Fallujah. The recent upturn in violence in Iraq led Britain to acknowledge today that it is considering sending more troops. The Pentagon is considering doing the same, and earlier this month announced that 20,000 American soldiers due to come home would have to stay in Iraq for an extra 3 to 4 months. One of those soldiers, who thought he was on his way home, is Specialist Roman Diaz of the Army's 1st Armored Division. After a year in Iraq, he was scheduled to board a plane out of Baghdad on April 12th. Instead, he was told he will most likely have to stay until September. That news hit Roman's mother, Sue, hard. In this radio diary, Sue Diaz describes the emotional roller coaster she's been riding as the situation in Iraq deteriorates.
The photo, full of light, movement, and color, is beautiful. In it, a small group of Iraqi children are skipping, laughing, and running toward the camera on a dusty road near Baghdad. At the center, a boy waves a newspaper high above his head. In the low sun of early evening, the children's long shadows fan out in the direction of the person taking the picture. The photographer, a kid himself not all that long ago, is an American soldier. That soldier is my son, Specialist Roman Diaz, 1st Armored Division. Back in December, a few months after his 20th birthday, he snapped this photo from the back of his army vehicle the day Saddam Hussein was captured. He used a small digital camera he'd brought with him on his deployment to Baghdad last spring. In the email that arrived with the photo as an attachment, the same young man, who typically begins his internet messages with "yo," wrote with a maturing sense of life and history, "It is a time of great hope here in Iraq." Looking at that photo then, I too felt some hope that this war I'd been against from the beginning would, in the long run, turn out okay. Now, 4 months later, that hope hides in shadows dark as the smoke from burning Humvees, black as the charred bodies dragged through the streets of Fallujah. It was Easter Sunday, April 11th, and we were talking online, he and I, via instant messaging. More than a month before, Roman had told me and his dad not to send him any more care packages, cards, or letters, because his unit was scheduled to leave Iraq soon. They'd been there nearly a year, and were looking forward to heading home in the next couple weeks. Since then, the news out of Iraq has not been good. Every day brings new images of fist-shaking, gun-carrying mobs, kidnappers in ski masks, cowering hostages, bloodied men in desert khaki, bandaged children in hospital beds. Liberation, it seems, has been redefined. "What's it like for you guys these days?" I typed on my computer screen that Sunday. "Tiring, hot, dusty, chaotic at times," Roman wrote. "It's like the whole country here has lost its mind." "Well, all I can say is I'm glad it's near the end of your time there." The box where his words appeared on my screen stayed blank. I watched it and waited for his reply. "Mom," he finally typed, "don't make me say it." My heart jerked. He had confirmed what I'd read in the newspaper, that some, not all, of the 1st Armored Division might soon be getting orders to stay 3 to 4 months longer. They did, and I chose to believe my boy wouldn't be among them, but he is. I blinked back tears so I could keep reading. So what do people in a family talk about when facing a reality that feels so unreal? Other things. The weather, his recent promotion to specialist, SpongeBob, his pet turtle that I've been making salads for every day since he left, our Easter plans at Aunt Irma's, jokes about government-issued jelly beans. A little later I typed, "I'm always hopeful things will turn out better than we think." His response to this echoed the disillusionment more and more Americans feel these days when opening a paper or turning on the evening news. "I try not to have any expectations," he wrote with a weariness well beyond his years. It's a statement so at odds with what he said that day he snapped the sun-streaked photo of those happy Iraqi kids. It's hard to believe that was only 4 months ago. And I am light years away from the days when I could make the world right again for him with the promise of a 7-Eleven Slurpee. For families with loved ones over there, I'm afraid victory in this misbegotten war might come down to simply this: holding on to hope that our brave men and women come back to us whole. "You guys will get through this," I told him. "Yes, we will," he said. "And so will your mothers." "Yeah," he answered, "and wives and kids too." A few lines later, something called him away suddenly. "Gotta go, Mom," he wrote. And he was already offline before I could finish typing, "I love you."
Sue Diaz is a freelance writer and contributor to the Christian Science Monitor and On Point. She lives in San Diego, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.